Blog Talk Radio.
Radio one-on-one. Today we're going to have a double shot for you, though. We're going to have two authors on 1 hour. First up is going to be author William Leibowitz talking about his book, Miracle Man. And next we're going to have J.L. Abramo talking about her latest book, Circling the Runway. So let's get going here without any further ado, and let's kick off the show and let's welcome into our first guest. Again, his name is William Leibowitz. So William, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks a lot for having me, John. I appreciate it.
Hey, so let's just jump right in. We know you're on tour now with PartnersInCrimeTour.net, something that we really like to see, and we like to have a lot of the authors on and talk about their work. So your book, Miracle Man, came out, winner of a National Best Thriller Award. You have a lot of great ratings here in the United States and overseas. So give us the skinny on the book.
Okay, yeah, the book it tells the saga of a guy named Robert James Austin, who is the greatest genius in human history. We're talking about an intelligence level like that is 10 times Einstein. In short, nothing ever been like that before. And he has a very tragic beginning in his life, and it is inexplicable where this incredible intelligence came from, and that's sort of one of the underlying themes in the book that gets a little bit, you know, sort of metaphysical, because there's no genetic reason why he should have this intelligence or upbringing or anything like that. And what he decides to do after a series of tragedies in his young life is that he's going to dedicate this intelligence he has to finding cures for diseases, because he comes to the conclusion that the big drug companies, as people commonly call them, big pharma, that the big aren't actually interested in curing diseases. They just want to sell repetitive treatments. And he decides that he's going to use this incredible genius he has to actually wipe diseases off the map. Because of that, a lot of conflict develops, because the big pharmaceutical companies decide that he's their worst nightmare come true as he begins knocking off one disease after another, costing them billions of dollars. So they launch a series of plans to essentially try to deactivate him. At the same time, the government, specifically a organization that discovers him at a young age called the OSSIS, which is Office for Special Strategic Intelligence, they discover just how brilliant he is, and they place him in an educational program for kids in the United States that have what is called profound intelligence, which means that it's really completely out of the ordinary. But he is far superior to any kid they ever encountered. So, of course, what they want to do ultimately is move him into military development, aerospace, et cetera, because they view him as a natural resource. Once he decides that, no, he's not interested in that, then he becomes in some way their enemy, because they are determined one way or another to be able to capitalize upon this intelligence. Then there's other conflict with radical anti-Western groups that view him as sort of against God's plan, because he's, you know, just curing diseases right and left. So lots of twists and turns, lots of suspense, and it's readers are finding it a pretty wild ride, so to speak. And it's he's a great character because he's not some goody-goody perfect genius. He has a lot of internal problems, very complex psychologically, disturbed in some ways. So I think it really is a bit of an unusual story.
Now, when you were thinking about the book and you were thinking about writing the book Miracle Man, was it Robert James Austin, the character that kind of popped into your head, wondering if you did have the world's greatest genius, exactly what would that mean? Or were you thinking more along the lines of, hey, let's go after pharmaceutical companies, let's eradicate disease, but how would that actually, so what was it, the character, the plot, what kind of came first in your mind with the book?
Well, the first thing that came was the character, because I wanted to create like an anti-celebrity hero, a real anti-hero, because one thing that's, I think, kind of undermined our society in the last, 15 years or so with all this reality TV is that it used to be people became famous because they actually could do something special. They had a real great talent. Now people become famous and rich by just being in our faces all the time, And I also thought, so many of our heroes these days, all the Marvel comic stuff, which is great, I'm not knocking it, but it's all, superpowers and all that. And I began to think, would it be really great, kind of inspirational, to have someone who doesn't fly through the air, so he's not that kind of superpower. He's a person, he's a regular person, a conflicted person. He happens somehow to have this extraordinary intellectual gift. And guess what? He doesn't go to Wall Street. He doesn't go to Silicon Valley to become a billionaire. He decides through tremendous self-sacrifice that he's going to use this incredible gift to better mankind. And guess what? He doesn't want to be in magazine covers, doesn't want to be on T-shirts. He wants to be anonymous, but do these wonderful things with this incredible talent. And I thought that would be refreshing because it is so different from everything that we see in real life. And so that was the idea. I wanted to create that kind of a modern age hero. And then, in thinking about it, I thought, well, what's weird? For the last 60 years, that like no disease has actually been cured. Everybody's taking expensive meds. A lot of people are on the same meds for like their whole lives, like with, anti-cholesterol and all this. How come with all the research and all the money spent decade after decade after decade, we're really not curing any diseases? And what occurred to me was there's a reason we're not, because if you cure a disease, it's game over. People take a vaccine like polio, and that's it, no more profit. But if you don't cure diseases and you keep people on maintenance drugs that are very expensive, there's a lot of money to be made. So I actually thought that this is a real problem in our society. And guess what? This extraordinary genius is going to not purposely take on the drug companies, but he is because of what he's doing. And to infuriate them, he doesn't want to make any money from all these cures. He is essentially putting it out generically so it is as cheap as possible, and, hence the conflict. So it really stemmed out of wanting to create a very unusual character, a character who is, really exceptional in not wanting what seemingly drives society at every level today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very, very complex character. I mean, and also, of course, you have people cheering him because he's doing it for the greater good of society. I'm trying to remember, was it the guy who invented penicillin or somebody? I'm trying to remember who it was that basically was just like, gave it away, and people are like, what are you doing? Why aren't you selling it? And he goes, because this is not something that needs to be sold. This is for the greater good of the world. It's not about making a profit.
Right, exactly, and
some people can't fathom that. Some people have a serious problem with fathoming doing something without getting any money for it or getting rich off of it, just doing it to do it. So that makes your character very unique in the way that he's not selfish, any monetary gains.
Yeah, it does. And the thing that adds a lot of depth to him, as I say, is that he's a complex character, because from the time he was a very small child, he began having serious nightmares. He goes into these trances, all of this kind of stuff that ultimately sort of points to someone who has some serious, like, psychological problems. And, of course, history has borne out that very often people of extraordinary intelligence or creativity, whatever, are very emotionally wrought people, and he has, like, some of that. But the interesting thing is that he, as time goes by, he begins to view illness and the combating illness as actually sort of a metaphysical kind of conflict, because he comes to the conclusion, as the years go by and he does research, that he believes that there is sort of a universal negativity, that there isn't, you know, if you believe in God, then there's a flip side to that, you know, that everything in the universe is balanced and there's a reciprocal to everything. So he actually begins to believe very strongly that one of the reasons why it is so hard to defeat simple organisms like cause malaria, for instance, is because they are being empowered by some kind of universal evil. So you have that. Well, that's not a big theme in the book. It's an undercurrent that I think it's really interesting, because it's, you have the conflict at a very realistic level, the government, the drug companies, but to him, the actual most important conflict is on a very metaphysical level. And we don't know, is that because he's crazy, or is he actually right, because he's such an extraordinary genius that he has seen things that other people can't see and fathom. So there are a lot of different levels that I think, you know, really create some interest and thought for the reader.
Well, let's get into some of the secondary characters, some of the other ones that are in there. You know, let's talk about the two women that also, you know, show up in the book that help aid and all the things that they have to bring to the table.
Yes, you have some really strong female characters in the book. One of them is a lady who becomes his personal assistant, who had a very difficult life herself, but got stronger from it, and she becomes, in effect, almost his surrogate mother, so to speak. And you know, she's a great lady and helps him in many ways. The other character is a lady that he meets, and I won't say how he meets her because that's part of the plot, but she's a beautiful scientist, and ultimately they end up having really a special love relationship, romance, and all that. But that also gets complicated because of how they met, why they met, etc. So that becomes yet another very important part of the conflict in the book. But at the end of the day, it is a real love story, that aspect. But once again, a lot of twists and turns around that love story.
Now, which character did you see yourself having a less voice, but ended up becoming a bigger voice within the story? So which character kind of surprised you by, you know, really shining through and saying, wow, I had no idea that they were going to be, you know, this big within the book?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, John. I would say probably, the individual whose name is Oren Varnes, who was the head of this OSSIS, Office for Special Strategic Intelligence, who ultimately becomes the head of the CIA. He, you know, grows a lot in the book in terms of his relationship with Robert Austin and becomes, I think, more of an important character. And a lot of readers have said that they were surprised the way he sort of grew as a character and all. So I think he developed in a very interesting manner, because you begin to really see like the depth of feeling that he has for Austin, who originally was really just a tool for him, when he landed up discovering, you know, this kid's extraordinary ability.
Mm-hmm. And tell a little everybody about your, again, we're talking here with author William Liebowitz. The book is called Miracle Man. Now, the website is miraclemanbook.com to find out more information about the book. So, William, what is your background? You know, how did you kind of get involved in writing thrillers?
Well, my background actually is I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for quite a few years, and I'm actually in the entertainment and media business in terms of my specialty. I've always enjoyed reading thrillers a lot, but writing this developed slowly over time. Originally, when I thought of the idea, I was thinking of maybe, you know, making it into some kind of a movie treatment. And then, you know, a few years ago, I actually decided to make it into a novel. There is a fair amount of science in this book because Robert Austin is discovering cures for real-life diseases. And so to give it plausibility, I have to have you know, sort of explanation for how he's doing this so it doesn't seem, you know, absurd to the reader. I have a pretty good science background from, mm-hmm. you know, college, and I'd went to a specialized science high school in New York and all that. But I had to do a lot of research to, once again, make the medical and scientific stuff in the book seem believable so that the reader wasn't being asked to make giant, you know, steps of faith. And what I'm happy about in the book is that a lot of readers have said that there was just enough science so it was believable, but not too much to, you know, become boring. It was just the right amount
right.
that, okay, wow, I believe this. And so that's sort of how all that came about.
Right, yeah, you kind of have to balance those things out. Like that would be, of course, if you were to write a legal thriller, you would have to really kind of balance out the law part because that's something that you know, but a lot of people might not know the intricacies of how everything goes on. So it is kind of a balance. And what would you say, was that probably the most difficult part of writing the book, is making sure that you had that correct balance in there?
Well, there were two things. One, the correct balance in the science. And as I say, I'm pleased that the consensus from readers has been that, you know, it works and it's not in any way, you know, overbearing. The other thing was to make his level of genius plausible because, you know, it's not easy for people to believe that somebody is 10 times, you know, smarter than Albert Einstein. And so I did a lot of research into real-life geniuses over the years because there have been biographies about some of them and a lot of research into the nature of extraordinary intelligence and genius. And so what I was able to do to make his level of intelligence plausible, I was able to kind of extrapolate actual things that have happened and have been documented with geniuses, pump it up to his level, but still have it like based in fact so that once again, it's plausible and believable And, you know, the reader doesn't think, oh, well, that could never happen. You know, the way it works in the book, the reaction has been, wow, you know, I get it. That could happen. As a matter of fact, some people have actually written that they thought for a while they were reading a biography as opposed to a novel. And I took that as a real compliment because it meant it was plausible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's always a great compliment when you get a compliment of that nature, just because I always tell people, hey, you know what, make sure that you write characters that are rememberable, even if they're hated, that's okay, but you need to make sure that you have an emotional reaction to the characters you write. You never want them to be forgettable. So when they're thinking
Absolutely.
About that, when they're reading, that's, you know, that's a great compliment.
Yeah, no, and you're completely right. You have to, you know, one thing when you talk about challenges in writing, I wanted him to be relatable and likable, because it would be so easy to just write about somebody who's some big nerd and nobody really cares. And what a lot of work went into in the character development was to make people care about him and like him and feel him, you know, and that has worked out really well. And the funny thing is, I've gotten great response from female readers who kind of like fall in love with him, you know, from some of the things they've written, which I was so happy about, because what it is, what appealed to them was his vulnerability and his sort of, you know, like sort of semi-tragic nature to him, but at the same time, so many great positive things. I had a few female readers who wrote, I just want to hug him. And I love that because it made me feel like, wow, I made him real to people.
And now when you were writing this, was this something that you were going to do as a series? Was this a straight standalone book? You know, give us an idea of maybe the future that what holds within your writing.
Okay, thank you. Originally, when I began writing it, I didn't really necessarily envision it as a series, but as it developed, I and the ending sort of, you know, almost demands a sequel, so to speak. I have decided that yes, it will be at least a two-parter, possibly three. And many readers have, you know, written like, please, please, like, go on, like, give us another book about him and where he goes from here. So I'm actually working on the sequel now, and that's going to be a lot of twists and turns, a lot of surprises and suspense in it. And the good thing about it is that because I'm picking up where I left off, I don't have to, you know, cover his whole life, because one of the very difficult things in writing the first book was I had to start with a kid when he was born and bring him to age 40, and that was very challenging to cover that span of time and events without writing a, you know, a 2,000 page book or having it be just crazy in terms of flashbacks, whatever. So the great thing about book two is that I won't have to do that because I'm picking up with him, you know, at age 40 or 42 or whatever it would be.
Mm-hmm. So you're having fun with going down the path, doing the tours, talking with people, getting everything out. I'm sure it was probably a little scary at the beginning because it's not something that you were maybe used to doing, even though you had been an attorney, but now having to go out and talk about your book and things like that. How has that experience been so far for you?
You know, it's been really positive, John, because I love hearing you know, what people think, their reactions, and the funny thing about when you write a novel and you create characters, the characters then actually seem like they're real live people. You know what I mean? Like they take on almost a physical presence. And so to see people respond to that, to talk about it, really has been a lot of fun, and is really gratifying, and feel that you have created characters that mean something to people, you know, because you obviously have been created out of thin air, so to speak. So I've definitely enjoyed it. It's been great, and I'm looking forward to it in the future.
Well, we got about 30 seconds to a minute left, so what I want to do is give you the last words and kind of let everybody know, you know, your websites or your Facebooks and all your social media, where people can contact you and maybe talk more about what you got going on.
Sure, thank you. Well, first thing is they can find the book on Amazon and see all the reviews and all that if they just go to Amazon, Miracle Man William Liebowitz, miraclemanbook.com. The website has all kinds of stuff on it that they will find interesting and my contact details. And there's also like some video on that they might find to be pretty entertaining and cool. So I really hope that listeners will check it out, and hopefully it will pique their interest when they read, you know, more about it on either Amazon or the website.
Well, I'll tell you what, William, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a pleasure. We wish you
thank
nothing
you,
but
John.
The best. Looking forward, you know, to talking with you later. So enjoy yourself and have a good one, and stay warm out there on the East Coast.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate it, John.
All right, have a good day. Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is author William Liebowitz. The book is called Miracle Man. Go to miraclemanbook.com for more information on the book and everything that William has going on. We are going to take a short break. We are going to be back with our next guest. Like I said, J.L., I believe it's Abramo. I'm not sure. We're going to have to find that out because I'm terrible with last names. I always tell people that. For some reason, I'm just not good at sounding things out. So we're going to go with J.L. Abramo right now and see if that's true. But in the meantime, here you go.
Hello, everybody, and I'd like to talk to you about some upcoming releases that are out now. Arthur Barbara Petty delivers the first book in a new series called What Has Mother Done? The title itself suggests a riveting mystery wrapped up within a drama. Reviewers have agreed that Barbara penned a winner, so check out Amazon.com for more on What Has Mother Done by Barbara Petty. Five gripping new mysteries await you from publisher Camel Press: Stealing the Golden Dream, Due for Discard, and Split to Splinters are just a few of the wonderful books being published by Camel Press. Check out all their titles by visiting camelpress.com. The Thriller Master is back with a sequel. Yes, David Morrell releases Inspector of the Dead, which brings back character Thomas DeQuincy. Murder as a Fine Art was the first book and was listed on several of the top lists in 2014. Now experience more of 1850s London and Inspector of the Dead. Go to davidmorrell.net for more information on these and all of his books. Kensington Kills. Well, not really, but their books sure do. And author Lisa Jackson and M. William Phelps, A.J. Tana, and more deliver explosive action and intrigue with every page. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on these and every title they have to offer, and you won't be sorry. Suspense Theater comes alive with Amon Kabachnik. His Blood on the Stage books bring readers a wealth of material for lovers of the stage, says the Los Angeles Times. Check out Where Stories Come Alive and visit Amon Kabachnik for more information on all six of these titles. And that's AmonKabachnik.com. A Century-Old Tale Leads to a Fortune in Bandit Gold. That's the adventure that Jack Farrell faces in his latest adventure, Murrayana Gold, by author William Nickel. This is the fourth book in the series. And visit William Nickel, that's 2Ks, EL.com for more information on this and the entire series.
So welcome everybody here after the break. Again, we want to thank author William Liebowitz for being on first to talk about his latest book. Now we're going to jump in with our next guest, and I was correct, it is Abramo. So we are going to talk with author J.L. Abramo and talk about his book called Circling the Runway. So J.L., thank you so much for coming on today, and how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's a pleasure to be with you. I wish I was there physically. I'm an ocean lover, and living in Denver, I get to miss it quite often. I do write my book set in on the oceans, the Atlantic and the Pacific, so vicariously I do get to the ocean now and then.
But I'll tell you, Denver is a gorgeous area. It's a very gorgeous place to, you know, into the mountains and everything that's going on in Colorado. A lot of people don't realize that Colorado is, I mean, it's very deserty on the west side. Then you have the mountains in the middle. You have the plains on the eastern side. It's a very complex state. Been through it many times. So I always liked Colorado.
Yeah, I have no complaints. It's a beautiful place.
So let's jump right in now to your book. It's called Circling the Runway. It's your latest in a Jack Diamond mystery series. So why don't you tell everybody the backstory here into the book, Circling the Runway?
All right, John. Let me talk about Jake Diamond first, just to give an idea of who this character is and how he came about. The first book in the series was called Catching Water in a Net. And it was set in the year 2000, published in 2001. Jake Diamond is a Brooklyn guy who had aspirations of being an actor. Started out in New York City doing, you know, the off Broadway thing, and then ultimately decided to go out to Los Angeles to see if he could break into the movies. And he was not too successful at it. But he met a private eye named Jimmy Pidgeon along the way. Jimmy had been on one of the movie sets where Jake had a small part, and he was doing some work with the actors in the movies, you know, as a consultant. And it got Jake a little bit interested in, you know, in the private investigation field, being that his acting career wasn't taking off. And ultimately he teams up with Jimmy and then ultimately goes up and starts his own PI business in San Francisco. So this book, Circling the Runway, is actually the fourth in the series. Now, the first three in the series came out, you know, quickly. They were published between 2001 and 2004. But then I worked on some other projects in between, and so this book comes out as the fourth book, but it's at least a decade since the last Jake Diamond book. So it was a good experience. A little frightening. I was worried about still being comfortable and familiar with the characters, but I found that I was very comfortable with them. It was like a reunion with old friends, actually. I set the book
in 2000. Yeah, I was going to ask that, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because that was going to be a question I was going to ask, so yeah, so go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it came, you know, it was like, you know, when you have a good friend, even if you haven't seen them for 10 years, when you see them again, it's like you pick it up like it was yesterday, and that's the way it went. And that was a good experience. I set the book in 2004 because you know, I didn't want Jake Diamond and the other characters to have aged 10, 11 years. So I set it back in 2004 so that it follows pretty much immediately on the heels of Counting to Infinity, which was the third in the series. As far as my thoughts, when I started writing the book, I had some ideas that I wanted to explore. There's a lot of recurring characters in the Jake Diamond books. And, you know, William earlier was talking about writing a sequel, if he writes a sequel, not having to deal with, you know, all of the backstory of his character. I've tended to reveal backstories of Jake and the other characters not all at once. I mean, I develop it over the book or over the series so that there's always something new you can learn about a character as the subsequent books arrive. Mm-hmm. And so I had this idea of taking one of the characters that that people who have read the previous books are familiar with, who's a well-liked, respectable character, and putting her in a position where she's under suspicion. So that was one of the ideas that I had for the book. The other mm-hmm. was I wanted to take two characters who traditionally did not get along very well and put them in a situation where they had to partner up to see what that would be like, you know, reluctant partners, so to speak. An odd couple. And so, that was part of the book. And the other thing is all the Jake Diamond books, John, he's a – I always describe him as more over-easy than hard-boiled, okay? And he's – rather than toting a gun around, he's usually, carrying a dog-eared paperback of a classic literature. He's a reader. So mm-hmm. in Catching Water in a Net, the first book, he's reading A Tale of Two Cities, and I like to work the book that he's reading somehow into the story that's going on with him.
Sure.
Indirectly, but, so in Catching Water in a Net, he's reading A Tale of Two Cities, and it's a book that's kind of about San Francisco and Los Angeles rather than Paris and London. My thoughts about Circling the Runway was I was thinking about The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and so I have Jake reading The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and there's some parallels between that story and Circling the Runway. So those were some of the elements that that came to mind as I was thinking about what I wanted this book to be.
Now, I do have one question, though, because kind of with the series, is why did you feel that you needed to kind of stop writing him when you did 10 years ago? I mean, was it just a matter of, hey, I want to do something else? I'm just not, you just didn't have really ideas to move forward. What was the reasoning for stop writing him?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, my original publisher decided not to go with another Jake Diamond book. So that was fine. But being that I didn't have to come up with another one right away, I started thinking about some other projects that I had been playing around with for a long time that was a standalone. And I thought, well, this is a good time to get back to that. And so I put my energy into working with that. And it became a book that's called Gravesend. And Gravesend is a book that takes place in Brooklyn in the neighborhood where I grew up. And so it was a good experience for me to kind of go back and revisit that. And I learned a lot about it. T.S. Eliot said, we shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And in many ways, that's what that experience was. So Gravesend became a book about, people and their relationships and basically three Brooklyn police detectives in a precinct in Gravesend. I worked on that. I was very fortunate, John, and that Eric Campbell from Down and Out Books reached out to me about 5 years ago, and he wanted to bring the Jake Diamond books back because they were out of print. And so he immediately put them all out as ebooks, and then he asked me if I had something else, and I gave him Gravesend, and he really liked it, and so then that happened. And then after that, I was thinking about this character named Jimmy Pigeon, who I mentioned a little earlier. Jimmy Pigeon is the guy who brought Jake into the business, and he was like a mentor and a friend to Jake. At the very beginning of Catching Water in a Net, he finds out from a woman who just comes into his office that Jimmy Pigeon was killed, and so the book becomes Jake's trying to find out what happened. But at the same time, Jake is thinking, why am I hearing this from a stranger? And if Jimmy was in some kind of trouble, why didn't he reach out to me? And he refers to Jimmy a number of times in the first three books in the sense of things that he learned from Jimmy or asking himself the question, you know, what would Jimmy do in this situation? And I began to wonder about Jimmy Pidgeon. He's a character who seemed very interesting, but I killed him off before I even began the series. So I had this thought of doing what writers and God can do, bringing a character back to life. So I turned the clock back to 1994 and okay. and did a Jimmy Pidgeon book called Chasing Charlie Chan. And so that was a project that took up some time, but it was a lot of fun to do. And then ultimately, you know, because people kept asking me, you know, what happened to Jake? Is he coming back? What's going on? I said, well, let me see what Jake's all about and what he's up to. And so I started the Circling the Runway.
Now, again, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with J.L. Abramo, and you can go to jlabramo.com, A-B-R-A-M-O.com. And the one thing I'm going to try to guess here, because on your website you have a picture of a boardwalk, and I'm familiar with the East Coast a little bit, so I want to see if I can guess, is this Asbury Park?
No, actually, John, it's Coney Island.
Okay.
Because,
you know, I was going to guess that just, it was with the tower was throwing me off, and I'm like,
that's the old parachute jump, which when I was a kid was actually a ride. It was moved from the 39 World's Fair. Now it's a national monument, and it's not in use anymore, but it's still there. That was the famous parachute, what they call the parachute jump. And, you know, I used Coney Island because Gravesend was near Coney Island. In fact, you know, growing up as a kid in Brooklyn, people don't realize this, but it's like being in a beach community in a sense. People don't sometimes relate, you know, New York City to the beach, but during the summer we went to the beach pretty much every day. And Gravesend and the Gravesend Police Station are quite close to Coney Island, so I thought that would be a good image.
Yeah, I tell you, I love it. I mean, it does bring you back when you see things like this in the old boardwalks, and I mean, it takes you back to a time. Because the one thing, like I've been mentioning to a lot of authors and a lot of, you know, people about reading books is I'm actually kind of sick about reading books with a lot of technology. It's taking away a lot from the story when everything is found out on the cell phone or everything is found out on the internet or, you know, you're having all these scientific tests and everything. The characters are no longer having to really do any detective work. They're no longer having to really do anything except hitting a couple keys, hitting some button, talk to one person, and everything is right in front of them, and then it's solved. Have to get away from that?
I don't know. I think because I was always more interested in the footwork aspect of it. You know, the hands-on procedural type of thing.
Right. It's
very procedural. There's nothing fancy about it. It's just like, you know, doing the work. And you know, I think just as you find it, I find it more interesting because it gives you a better chance to look at the people and how they think and how they act and how they react rather than, you know, look at how good they are at looking at, you know, computers or whatever that is.
Exactly. I think that it takes away from the character aspect of the, you know, the story. I think it does. I don't feel as engaged, I guess you want to say, when everything is so technology. So it's good when you see, you know, characters actually having to talk with other characters and literally just find out about who they are as a person or what kinds of things that they're hiding. Besides tapping a phone or doing, you know what I mean? Doing all those kinds of things that just makes it too easy.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about Gravesend, not to get off Circling the Runway, because of course that's our main concern today, but Gravesend is really, it's about people. It's a crime novel, but that's just the genre. That's the surface of it. But there's a lot of things going on in Gravesend where characters, good and bad, kind of cross paths. They come very close to each other without realizing it. And mm-hmm. and it's kind of interesting because it gives it a kind of almost a small town feeling, even though it's Brooklyn is the fourth largest city in the United States. But it's kind of fun to have, you know, these kinds of near misses go on until ultimately it all comes, you know, crashing together at the end.
So now, besides the amount of time that you had to spend between books here in the series, what was the most difficult part, or what was the one thing that you wanted to make sure that you got through to the reader in the book Circling the Runway?
Well, I wanted a book that pretty much followed on the heels of the previous book, so I didn't want it to feel like a lot of time had passed.
Okay.
So you know, I had to keep that in mind. Of course, you know, I had to research the period because when I'm sitting here in 2014 writing about 2004, I have to make sure that, you know, I'm right on about what was going on in 2004 in San Francisco and L.A., what was going on in the country culturally, the music, the movies, the politics, the news, so on and so forth. So I love that kind of research, but you have to be, you know, you have to be accurate with it. You also have to be accurate with the place. Readers will suspend their disbelief on a number of, you know, they'll do that. But if you have two streets in the book that are crossing and they don't cross in real life, a little thing like that can throw a reader off. So, you know, I have to be really careful about your setting, and I always make the setting kind of important to what's going on. You know, I have Jay travel around a bit. You know, he moves around a little bit. And in Circling the Runway, there's quite a bit of action that takes place in Oakland. And I don't know Oakland at all, so I had to do a lot of research to make sure that I was correct about, you know, Oakland. And again, it's a learning experience, and it's a lot of fun to do.
I mean, I'm going to tell you, Jake Diamond just sounds like a guy who's walking the streets of San Francisco with a cigarette in his mouth, checking everything out. I mean, he just sounds like that type of guy.
He's funny too. He's got a great sense of humor. I got a nice word from an Edgar Award winning writer, S.J. Roseanne, recently, who just read the book, and she just loved the one-liners. And the other thing is there's a great relationship between Jake and his associate, Darlene Roman, and she's been with him from the beginning. And they have a great rapport, which is often, you know, very funny. It's smart and funny. And, you know, I think that humor is important, not only to the character, but just to the book itself, and readers seem to enjoy it quite a bit.
Now, the other thing is you were off for quite some time in this kind of genre. You were, you know, you were doing other kinds of things, so they had to get back. Well, publishing 10 years ago has changed to the nth degree. So now that you're going out and you're marketing and you're talking and you're back out and you're into this, you know, into this mystery and this suspense and these genres, how was it for you to have to try to go, wow, this is a lot different than it was before, and what kind of struggles are you still going through in order to kind of maneuver your way through this odd publishing marketing thing that's going on right now?
Well, you know, John, it's it is different, and promoting a book is more difficult than writing a book. I mean, frankly,
exactly right.
Yeah, and you know, and when you're a writer, you don't necessarily want to be a salesman at the same time, but it's necessary. But you know, I'm careful about where I go to promote a book. You know, I mean, I would like the venue or the situation to be something that I respect and admire. I'm not looking to get it out there, you know, on any blog or any, you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I appreciate being on here because I've been a listener and I like what you do.
Thank you.
It's different. You know, I don't know how much time we have left, but I'll tell you.
We got a good 5-6 minutes left.
All right, let me tell you a quick interesting story in terms of, you know, doing a virtual tour is a different thing, and it's definitely a 2015 thing. We wouldn't have had that in 2001 when the first book came out, really. And then, you know, you had to kind of, you know, leg it around, to various places to do book signings and whatever. But the thing, I was talking about Fetching Water and that, and how something in the back of my head, I had left California, San Francisco. I had lived in Denver and San Francisco and moved back to the East Coast because I missed the East Coast and the Atlantic Coast. And I was there for quite a while and kind of lost touch with close friends that I had in Denver and in San Francisco. It just happens. Time goes by, you just lose touch. And I think in the back of my head, that's what I was writing about when I wrote Catching Water in a Net, because he finds out that Jimmy Pigeon was killed. He finds out from a stranger, and Jimmy didn't reach out to him. And he realizes it's because he didn't make himself accessible. And I think that was subconsciously in the back of my mind. And so when I wrote the book, it turned out to be the theme of it, at least, you know, I realized, was about the responsibility of friendship and kind of making yourself accessible and keeping in touch, at least occasionally, whatever. And the beautiful part of it, John, was that when the book was published, I had a chance to come out here to Denver from the East and go out to San Francisco to do some events, and I reconnected with all my old friends. So, you know, the book allowed me to do something that in the back of my head I realized I should have been doing all along. And, you know, that's part of what happens when you're writing, whether you know it or not. You know, you're writing about something that you need to express. You're not preaching, you're not, but it's there. It's there underneath, you know, the general plot or whatever it is. And so that was a kind of a good story about the first book, and yeah, it worked out real well.
Nice. Yeah, I love how, you know, the stories kind of happen and how, because a lot of people, a lot of authors want a roadmap. They want to say, this is, you do number A, or letter A, then B, then C, then D, then E, and this is how you become successful in writing. But the problem is, it's not like that. There is no path. There is no magic formula. There is no way. It's just a matter of writing the absolute best book that you can, you know, and just going out there and just pounding it and pounding it and pounding it and getting it done. And so I feel you know, that's the journey you have to do, which is why I say when you write the end, it's only the beginning. Writing the book is the easy part. Getting people to buy it and read it is the hard part. And I think a lot of new authors who are throwing their book out there on Kindle struggle with that. They're like, well, my book's out there now, people should buy it. And it's like, yeah, yours and 1.5 billion other books are out there. Now go find it.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, a lot of it is, a lot of it is luck. But, you know, if, and it's word of mouth, John, and all of that. I've been told, you know, I've been told by, you know, in the past by publishers or other people, you know what's hot right now is so-and-so. You know, it's the CSI stuff is hot, but, you know, the serial killer is hot. That's what you should write. And I say, well, I can't write that. You know, I don't feel that. You know, I have to write something that I know about and something that interests me, because if it doesn't interest me, it's certainly not going to interest a reader. And so it's exactly what you say. You do that. There's no stencils. I never know what the end of the book is going to be when I begin.
Oh,
you know, it develops. it develops as I go along. And a lot of times, you know, you get to that point where, okay, now I understand where this is going to end, but I can't get there from here. It's like you painted yourself into a corner type of thing. And so
you
I
have to kind of go back and move yourself up.
I have to backtrack till I get to that other fork and then go that way. But that's all a learning experience, and it's all what it is, you know, because it's a journey. It's a journey with a lot of surprises, but it's got to surprise me. If it doesn't surprise me, I can't expect it to surprise anybody else, and it does surprise me quite often.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful. And I hope a lot of authors actually, you know, take the time to research and see what it's like to actually have to go out there and sell a book, and don't just say, oh, well, it's on Kindle and people should buy it. And no, it's so much more than that. But, hey, I want to give you, though, the last minute or so. We got about a minute left to, like, let people know where they can find you, what you got going on, the whole nine yards. So it's all up to you now.
Okay, well, I'll repeat what you said earlier. I have a website. Which is, www.jlabramo.com, no spaces or anything like that. A lot of information there about all the books. I have a Facebook author's page, which is, you know, kind of fun to keep up with and like if people like it. And that's www.facebook.com/jlabramo. Right now I just finished a group of stories, like a novella and some short stories that are all interrelated, you know, so it reads pretty much like a novel, but it's separate stories, but they're tied together, at least with characters and in the time frame, and that's probably going to be next up, hopefully fairly soon. And that takes place in Brooklyn. I went back to Brooklyn again for that, a Brooklyn PI
at
Coney Island. And then, you know, I've been working on follow-up to Gravesend because a lot of people want to know, you know, as William said earlier, when people get familiar with certain characters, if they're interested, they'd like to know, you know, okay, you know, where do they go from here? And so that's what I've been working on at the moment. But Surfing the Runway is a fun book. Whether people have read Jake Diamond or not, I think they'll enjoy it. And hopefully, if they enjoy it, they'll go back pick up the earlier books.
Well, I want to tell you, Jay, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you. I wish you nothing but success with the book and everything you have going forward, looking to see how Jake Diamond keeps continuing on in the literary world.
Okay, well, John, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. You have a great day, and we will talk with you soon.
Okay, take care, John. Bye.
Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author J.L. Abramo, and you can visit his website at jlabramo.com for more information. We also want to thank our last guest who was on, and that was William Lieberwitz. You can check him out at miraclemanbook.com for more information. Of course, all of our radio shows are on SuspenseRadioNetwork.com to see our latest schedule. Tomorrow is going to be Beyond the Cover is back with Simon Gervais. You won't want to miss Simon, a security expert, been involved in many governmental things, protection. Very good. It's going to be an extremely interesting show to kind of hear the insides of that. So again, SuspenseRadioNetwork.com. Yesterday, of course, was Crime and Science Radio with Hank Philip P. Ryan. If you didn't hear that one, you are really missing out on Crime and Science Radio. So we want to thank you all. Enjoy. Until next time, see you all. Keep reading. Bye-bye.